first in our series of four lectures is being delivered, of course, by Professor Stephen Macedo, who is the Lawrence S. Rockefeller Professor of Politics and the University Center for Human Values, as well as the director of that center. As most of you know, or all of you know, Professor Macedo is well known for writing on issues in political theory, ethics, public policy, law, and a bunch of other topics. His books include Diversity and Distrust, Civic Education in Multicultural Democracy, and Liberal Virtues, Citizenship, Virtue, and Community and Liberal Constitutionalism. I won't say anything more about his many impressive credentials, which you can look up if you care to, except to say we are absolutely delighted he's here and welcome him to speak to us today on democracy and moral governance. Steve?
Democratic culture. Share and share alike. Well, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here, and I've never been to Vanderbilt before. It's a lovely campus, and I appreciate the invitation and hospitality. I did switch my topic a bit, with Rob's permission. So I'll be talking in the class about things related to public reason and religious citizens and so on later on, but I'm going to talk about something which is sort of close to what I'm working on now, but this is the first. I did a version of this at Texas last week, but this is the first time I've talked about it. So it's a work in progress, and I'm sure many people in the room know more about many aspects of this than I do. But it's about democracy and international institutions. The question is, and this is also includes a substantial institutional component, as well as some democratic theory. So I hope the philosophers will forgive that. And the question is how we should think about the burgeoning array of international institutions and international regimes in which the United States is participating from the standpoint of democratic principles, the sort of principles that we regard as important to the legitimacy of our domestic political order. So the question is, do international institutions undermine democracy specifically? And most commentators who look at various of these institutions argue that they do. Even those who support international institutions often argue that there's a trade-off between the protection of human rights, the promotion of free trade, and other sorts of aims, protection of the environment, likely as well, and democratic governance, participation, and so on. And so that's the sort of question I want to interrogate. Yale law professor Jed Rubenfeld puts it this way, and I quote, "International law is anti-democratic. The existing international governance organizations are famous for their undemocratic opacity, remoteness from popular or representative politics, elitism, and unaccountability. International governance institutions and their officers tend to be bureaucratic, diplomatic, technocratic, everything but democratic. That's why internationalization, as Ralph Dorendorf put it, almost invariably means a loss of democracy." So that's the question I want to consider. And the sentiments, as I say, that suggest that there is this trade-off or run across the political spectrum. Jeremy Rabkin, in an important book, Law Without Nations, argues that liberal elites are using international institutions to undermine American constitutional self-government. And the liberal philosopher Thomas Nagel in the New Republic gave the book a positive review. For reasons I think that I'll try to explain, there's a connection between Rabkin's claims about constitutional democracy and the sorts of claims about peoples and the special responsibilities that citizens have to one another, according to Rawls's argument in the Law of Peoples, and something that Nagel also sympathizes with. And obviously, intellectuals across the political spectrum, activists Ralph Nader, William Greider, and others have argued for the corrosive effects on democracy of various forms of international governance regimes. So the aim of these remarks will be to argue for the proposition that participation in international institutions can not inevitably, and not always, but can be good for democracy in the US, even if these institutions are not themselves especially democratic. The arguments like this have been made with respect to the European Union and so on, but I want to think about the argument in terms of the United States in particular. And both Rabkin and Rubenfeld specifically talk about American democracy and internationalization. So I'll argue that many democracy-based criticisms of international institutions go wrong in part in their conception of democracy, part of the argument will be how should we think about democracy, and how should we think about the relationship between institutions that are remote from direct popular accountability, even domestically, and the project of democratic self-governance. And so I'll make a certain argument about democracy, how we should best understand democracy. And then obviously the other part of it will be about international institutions and whether international institutions in some ways can be extensions of the sort of strategies that we would associate with domestic constitutionalism when it comes to thinking about how to perfect or realize the project of collective self-governance. And I should emphasize, again, I'm sort of doing some work on this, getting started on it, but the international institutions part will be kind of fragmentary, and I'd be very interested in hearing what other people have to say about it who probably know more about this. In a sense, the structure of the argument is that if it was the case with respect to the original Constitution that moving governance up to a higher level, you know, would be good, not just for various public goods and so on, but would be good for democracy, and I think that's the best way to understand the argument of the Federalist Papers. Well, there may be similar ways in which moving governance up to a higher level could be good for democracy, even when it involves moving up to the level of international institutions. And this means interpreting the project of the Founding Fathers, the argument in Federalist Papers and so on, as a democratic project, essentially, rather than as a falling away from a democratic moment that followed the revolution prior to the establishment of the Constitution. So that'll be the first part of the substantive part of the argument, and then talking about international institutions a bit. But to begin, let me say something in a little bit more detail about the critique, democracy-based critique of international institutions offered by Rabkin in particular. Who describes the aim of his book as, and I quote, "to explain why American constitutional traditions make it hard for the United States to embrace schemes of global governance which find so much favor in other countries, particularly in Western Europe." And his argument is complicated, and there's lots of aspects to it, but there's a theme that runs through it. This will be my gloss on the core of the argument as I understand it, but glossing it in this way gives the argument broad currency, I think, and you'll see how there's a connection with the Rawls-type arguments. And his specific claim is that the sovereign independence of the political community is essential to democracy. As he puts it, and I quote, "something serious is at stake beyond temporary partisan advantage. Long before it was a great power, the United States took pride in having a democratic and constitutional government. Americans took pride in governing themselves according to their own rules." So sovereignty is the final authority to make and enforce law, to resolve disputes concerning the law. It's the power to decide without having to answer to a higher power, to a power outside the political community. And it's not difficult to see why sovereignty would seem important to the integrity of the project of collective self-rule by the people. So the crux of the claim here, I think, is that citizens of a democracy owe it to one another to channel their political disputes through their own political forms and institutions. They owe it to one another to settle their disagreements via shared democratic institutions. And indeed, they owe it to one another to preserve the capacity of those institutions to take final decisions regarding their collective well-being. Cooperation with other states via treaties is fine, but democratic sovereignty should be preserved, which is our collective capacity as a political community to make our own decisions regarding ourselves, to make our own binding law. I think this is compatible with Rabkin's core assertions, but it also makes clear the central linkages with democratic politics in a way that I think registers its appeal with folks like Nagel and John Rawls in the Law of Peoples, whose argument I think is essentially that distributive justice applies with special force within political communities because they're communities that are projects of collective self-governance. We make decisions, create law, create institutions that shape each other's life chances from cradle to grave in a way that's uniquely consequential and uniquely comprehensive in its reach. And that exertion of collective power over each other as members of a political community means we have special justificatory burdens one to another. And the principles of distributive justice help make it clear insofar as they inform the institutions of our society, that everyone matters as an equal, and indeed it makes plain to those who do least well that they matter as moral equals insofar as the institutions satisfy principles like fair equality of opportunity, giving everybody a chance to succeed, and the difference principle, Rawls's distributive principle, which make clear to the least well-off in particular that they have a stake in the system even when they're doing least well. The inequalities have been set up so as to be to their maximum advantage. You don't have to know all the details, but the idea is that justice and democracy, collective self-governance, let's put it that way, go together. And there are certain ways in which there are strong justificatory burdens that we owe within a course of political order. And when Rabkin suggests in this book that there's something disloyal about the agenda of liberal internationalists, I think he means to say that this agenda represents a betrayal of our responsibilities as citizens of a political community. Our responsibility is to offer one another reasons to justify the way we think our collective affairs to be settled and to work out our disagreements through our own settled institutions. Now, how does internationalism threaten democracy? Well, international law and multilateral institutions furnish elites with avenues, this critique, I'm representing the critique now, furnish elites with avenues that allow them to bypass the onerous processes of persuasion and consensus seeking that democracy requires. Elite liberal internationalists may seek to leverage liberal values and practices into the United States without the consent of the American people through international institutions. They can operate through illegitimate backdoor international agreements, working with elites in Europe to bring about outcomes that they prefer. Liberal internationalism is thus portrayed as a form of illegitimate power arising from the machinations of liberal elites. Unelected NGOs can network transnationally and lobby for international rules that are gradually accepted as binding on the US without proper legislative deliberation and lawmaking. Commitments made through the treaty power may be incrementally expanded through the operation of international legal processes. Elites in the US, including judges, may use foreign law, international law, or multilateral institutions as justifications for imposing or revising domestic rules, for instance, limiting the application of the death penalty, without running the gamut of normal legislation. These criticisms do have some, these criticisms are in some ways reminiscent of New Right's original intent criticisms of judicial elites leveraging liberal outcomes into our politics through judicial review, through morally informed judicial review. And I think it's no accident that there's some similarity between these criticisms. And worst of all, these elite internationalists are creating global administrative bodies like the World Trade Organization with the power to resolve important questions touching on domestic affairs through independent governance mechanisms, the appellate bodies, which I'll say more about later on, that operate within the WTO, whose decisions are not subject to subsequent review by domestic institutions. So international institutions on this account furnish avenues of political influence that bypass domestic democracy in some ways. If American branches of Friends of the Earth or the National Resources Defense Council disagree with American environmental regulation or public policies regarding national security, torture policy, and so on, they may be able to file petitions with international bodies and exert influence over American domestic policy through these transnational avenues. And so powerful international bodies provide an alternative means of appeal and influence outside the normal channels of democratic constitutional democracy. And domestic political constituencies will increasingly develop a stake in the power of these international bodies, which itself could be help to foster this tendency that could be seen as coercive of domestic democracy. Now, Jed Rubenfeld at Yale has a slightly different version of this in a couple of pieces on American unilateralism, and I won't sort of go through the variations in his argument. He puts a lot of emphasis on the extent to which the Constitution itself is a democratic instrument that the people gave themselves in order to establish their own institutions of self-governance. And it's an interesting variation on these themes, but I think I've said enough about the critique. The crux of the connection between sovereign independence and the integrity of democracy, again, putting a kind of Rawlsian gloss on an argument that's really coming from the right in Rabkin's hands, is this special justificatory obligations that citizens have to one another. Special obligations on account of the fact that we impose coercive law on one another, that we're members of a shared political community, and that we owe it to each other to justify the law to one another, which is the point of these complex domestic institutions. Now, so I think this way of looking at it sort of gets clear what the crux of the problem is with international institutions. If Robert Dahl has an off-cited article on why international institutions can't be democratic, and he puts more emphasis on the scale and diversity of the scope of governance at the international level. And that sort of raises the question, well, just how much scale is too big and how much diversity is too much? And the problem there is the United States is already pretty big and pretty large, and India is very large, so it would suggest that projects of constitutional democracy are going to tend to be unsuccessful as well. However, I think the way that I've articulated the Rabkin type argument makes clear that there may be a more essential problem here, which is that the tension between domestic institutions through which we justify to one another versus international institutions that could be seen as providing an end run around those institutions or is undermining the integrity of a community that owes intense obligations of justification to one another. So the question is, how should we think about these charges? And look, I agree, there's lots of different international institutions, lots of different international governance regimes, and it certainly is worth being cautious about the mode of operation of these institutions and their effects and so on. So Rabkin and others are clearly right that we should cast a critical eye on these institutions. And he's also clearly right, I think, that the critical eye, the critical perspective we take on new institutions internationally or newer institutions internationally should include this question of democracy. How does this impact on our capacity as a community to govern ourselves democratically, not just, and if there's a trade-off between achieving important collective global public goods, like stopping the planet from frying, we may have to do that, trade that off against democracy, but it's also worth thinking about whether these important collective goods might be pursued in a way that would not undermine democracy. And so that's what I think is worth considering. And so the next part of the argument is, how should we understand democracy? If we understand these institutions to be at odds with democracy, how should we understand democracy? What's the relationship between, starting at the domestic level, constitutional structures, which are again often remote from direct electoral accountability, and democracy? And then might it be the case that international institutions might in some ways contribute to some of the strategies for enhancing democratic self-rule that the Constitution itself engages in effect? So, but then first, the next part is sort of constitutional democracy as democracy is what I think I'll argue for is the best way of understanding democratic values. So part of the problem, I think, with these discussions is there's a tendency to identify democracy with either sort of minimalist conceptions of democracy or the most direct and participatory forms of self-government. Minimalist conceptions of democracy, democracy as majoritarianism, democracy as majority rule, or democracy as identified very closely with electoral institutions and the electoral mechanism, is surprisingly popular and resilient. Samuel I. Sakharov, who's a very good scholar of democratic institutions, says at the beginning of a recent article, constitutionalism, and I'm quoting, constitutionalism exists in inherent tension with a democratic commitment to majoritarian rule. Well, why should we identify democracy with majoritarian rule? Sometimes people want to adopt simple understandings of democracy because they want to be able to classify regimes as democratic or not on the basis of very simple terms. So comparative politics people will sometimes have very simple definitions so that they can classify regimes simply. But minimalist conceptions of democracy, and certainly the majoritarian conception of democracy, it seems to me failed to account for the moral attractiveness of democracy. In the most straightforward way, democracy stands for government of the people, by the people, for the people. You've probably heard that one before. It's hard to see why we should interpret that as government of the majority, by the majority, and for the majority. So the most obvious democratic problem with simple majoritarianism is that it empowers 50% plus one to rule the rest. It gives some of the people all of the power, and it's hard to see why that is fair. An essential democratic problem with majoritarianism, then, is it fails to be sufficiently inclusive. It advances the cause of democracy to ensure that minority interests are represented. As my colleague Chris Eichgruber has put it, democracy demands a government that is inclusive enough so that all of the people and not merely the majority, can associate themselves with the project of self-government. To qualify as democratic, a government must respond to the interests and opinions of all the people, not merely a powerful faction. Now, if we think about the why, what do we make? I'd ask, what would it make of the frequency with which a political system such as the U.S. is described, nevertheless, as majoritarian democracy? I think the mistake is that at various points our political system employs a decision rule of majority voting or plurality voting, and the decision rule has some attractive features that can be decisive as long as the options are simple. You know, basically, as long as they've been reduced to two. Majority rule can be a good decision rule. But the fact that we employ majority decision rules at a certain point does not make our system majoritarian. Legislative bicameralism, the House and a Senate with separate constituencies arising from separate constituencies, amounts to a supermajority requirement. The further requirement of a presidential signature is another check on partiality. The president represents a distinctive national constituency. And each branch of the legislature has its own committee system, its own hearings, its own debate and deliberation, and so on, the purpose being to ensure that the measures that are eventually adopted have been tested and refined. The hope is that legislation will reflect an inclusive conception of the public good, and one that has been subjected to extensive public criticism and scrutiny in order to elicit, and this is sort of going back to the Political Science 101, Federalist Papers and all that, but it's good stuff, actually. To elicit the cool and deliberate sense of the community as a whole so that the public can own and identify with legislative measures over the long haul. So it seems to me institutions which may be remote from, which certainly are not majoritarian, but supermajoritarian and have other sorts of features, insofar as they are represent the value of inclusiveness with respect to legislative measures that are adopted, so that the measures tend to reflect the interests of the public as a whole, the good of the public as a whole, and insofar as they represent due deliberation, public criticism and scrutiny, such that the public might stably embrace the measures that are adopted as being reasoned and subject to due criticism and having been responded to due criticism, so that we can own and identify with policy over the course of time in a stable way. These are ways not of curbing or checking or limiting democracy, properly understood, but of realizing democracy, properly understood. Government of all the people, and government of all the people on due deliberation, reflecting a conscientious vision of the good of the good as a whole. This all sounds very idealistic and so on and so forth, and in some ways it is, but it also represents the hard-headed defense of constitutional institutions that were advanced by the Office of the Federalist Papers in the decisive debate in New York State. And of course, these papers were reprinted all over the place during the constitutional ratification. If the aim of American national institutions was to empower majorities, if the aim of American government was to create majoritarian democracy, it would be a miserable failure because it doesn't do so. Inclusion, so that the public legislation represents the public good, the general will, something of that sort, and deliberateness are two features that institutions should try to enhance, and when, insofar as they do so, that the measures can be public and represent publicly reasoned, the public reason, the reason of the public, this represents democracy enhancement, not democracy derailment. So the question then becomes, if we understand democracy this way, can international institutions, multilateral institutions, enhance this project of refining the legislative will, of refining the popular will as it gets embodied in legislation? And certainly there were three ways in which the framers thought that institutions should try to improve on anything might be associated with direct democratic will. One, of course, is control of factions, so that legislative measures that represent simply the good of a group within society, whether a well-placed minority or a majority whose interests were against the interests of the whole, faction control was one measure identified by Federalist Number 10. The enhancement of minority interests, likewise, insofar as institutions require that the interests of minorities who are apt to be neglected, minorities who have been subject to prejudice or discrimination, insofar as institutions help to ensure that their interests are taken into account in the process of lawmaking, that also is democracy enhancing because it gets closer to government in the interest of all rather than just some. And then I think a pervasive commitment to criticism, scrutiny, contestation, insofar as institutions require that before a measure is adopted, it's been subject to robust, well-informed criticism. Think of these as the sort of epistemic dimension of institutions, procedures that are put in place before a legislative measure is adopted. Insofar as institutions enhance decision-making along these dimensions, certainly, probably others that are worth considering, they institutions can be democracy-enhancing rather than democracy-derailing. Now, the argument of the Federalist Papers is that an extended republic, a national republic, can have advantages with respect to all of these dimensions as compared with small republics, government close to the people, especially the state legislators after the revolution, which were very closely connected with the people. 2-year terms in many state legislatures, unicameral legislature, a very weak executive, and opportunities for recall and instructions so that that representatives could be instructed to follow the will of their constituents, and if they didn't follow it, they could be removed. That was seen as a prescription for government on the basis of whim and caprice and not sufficient deliberation, and also governance on behalf of the interests of well-placed, powerful majorities, but also shifting government, government that was unstable because legislation adopted one day, not having been very well thought through, was rejected the next day, and so on. So I'm endorsing the argument of the founders of the Republic as a democracy-enhancing argument insofar as it has these features of improving the inclusiveness and deliberate quality. With respect to factions, obviously, the idea was that an extended republic, a large republic, would make it possible moving governance up to a higher level, combining representative government with the embrace of an extended republic would make it harder for factions to form, and if they form, make it harder for them to dominate legislation. The idea was if legislative districts encompass larger and more diverse constituencies, the interests that are represented will tend to be more inclusive. Entrenching rights can also be a way of enhancing democracy. Rights have all sorts of democracy-enhancing features, and I think it is unfortunate that Dworkin's influential discussion casts rights in the first instance as trumps against public interests as enacted through legislatures. I mean, the primary function, I think, of rights is to make it easier for public interests, public good, the public good to be represented in legislation. By taking some issues off the agenda, taking religion off the agenda of politics, we make it easier to govern with respect to the issues that remain on the agenda. And it enhances our capacity to govern ourselves on behalf of real public goods by simply getting religion off the agenda, because otherwise politics would be a matter of irresolvable conflict. By protecting minority rights to participate, associate, and even some privacy rights, of course, we make it easier for minority groups in particular, but many groups in society, to form their political opinions, to engage in thoughtful discussion of politics with the assurance that their essential prerogatives won't be invaded, to make it possible for groups to freely and confidently form and express their views on public matters. The reservation of rights can help to enhance democracy rather than to ensure it. And then, of course, you know, a la John Hart Ely and so on, insofar as there are mechanisms that can be put in place to enhance minority representation, that can also be good for democracy. Finally, institutions that encourage discussion, debate, the sifting of reason and evidence, even in ways that are remote from popular electoral connections, so that there are ways in which institutions that allow to be brought to bear in the legislative process, the process of policy making at various points, neutral expertise through administrative bodies and so on in the administration of law, that can help us take account of, that can be a strategy for democratic publics to ensure that the policies that are adopted are responsive to expertise with respect to various aspects of public policy. Taking some issues and assigning them to remote institutions like central banks or election commissions, as opposed to leaving the redistricting process to the political process itself, might enhance democracy by making sure that certain decisions are taken in a way that reflects a stable commitment to the public interest in financial matters and so on. And assigning some rights protections to politically independent courts can help to assure minorities that their interests will be taken account of. I won't go any further with this. This is familiar in some sense, but it's to remind ourselves that remote institutions can often be good for democracy. And finally, I'll just mention one powerful study of direct democracy in the United States, and I'm not always against direct democracy, the local level it often works perfectly well and so on, but take the California referendum system, which is a system of, that submits issues to the voters directly. David Broder's book on the California referendum system is really quite astonishing. It's called Democracy Derailed. What the referendum system does is to give well-placed special interests with money the power to craft ballot questions in a clever way, to dominate the campaigns leading up to the votes, to hire lawyers to then contest issues once they've been decided. And Broder describes this referendum-style direct democracy in California as a system which voters are, and I quote, dupes in a process manipulated by wealthy interests. That's true. That's not the full realization of democracy insofar as that discussion is accurate, insofar as that description is accurate. So nothing I'm saying here is original. The founders contrived a wide variety of ways to curb factions, protect minority interests, and assure robust criticism and wide discussion, due deliberation before measures are adopted. And then so in thinking about international institutions, how might it be the way that some of these strategies might be furthered by our participation in international institutions? So one avenue, and this, the part of this, I only just came across this recently, there's one aspect of this that's in some ways most straightforward would be with respect to special interests concerning trade. That's certainly one area where the original Constitution time and through the present day, if special interests dominating legislative process through protectionist measures is one longstanding way in which it's been feared that special interests will tend to win out over diffuse general interests. And indeed, there's an article in the Harvard Law Review by John O. McGinnis and Mark Movsesian called The World Trade Constitution that anticipates this part of the argument. And it's a good piece. So they talk about both the general agreement on tariffs and trade, and some of this is pretty nuts and boltsy, hands-on stuff, but I think it is about realizing democracy, and then also the World Trade Organization as mechanisms for empowering diffuse general interests domestically and strengthening their hand against well-placed special interests domestically. And insofar as these institutions operate in that sort of a way, that their domestic effect is to allow us to better pursue public policy in a way that our diffuse and general interests tend to predominate better over our well-placed special interests, then these institutions, even if they're remote in certain respects, can be democracy enhancing. So McGinnis and Movsesian say this: international free trade and domestic democracy share a common enemy, protectionist interest groups. Therefore, constitutive structures that restrain such groups, can simultaneously reinforce both trade and democracy. The Constitution itself was a kind of, some degree of free trade pact among the states, Federalist Number 23, to stop the states from enacting trade barriers against each other. By giving the power to regulate commerce to the national government, by requiring states to extend to citizens of other states whatever privileges and immunities they extended to their own citizens. And it was thought that national representatives would be more likely to rise above parochial interests, parochial special interests, than local representatives who might seek to protect local industries against other states. And subsequent to the Constitution, other legislative mechanisms were put in place to likewise facilitate the general interest with respect to trade. So the thought is that Congress, the National Congress, might be more prone to capture by special interests than the president. The chief executive represents a national constituency. Congressmen have smaller districts and they make lots of decisions in committees. So among the mechanisms that are devised to try to ward off special interest capture of trade is fast-track authority for the executive. The president gets to submit legislation on trade issues, implementing a trade agreement to Congress under procedures that prohibit amendments, that limit debate, and that require automatic discharge from committee in order to deprive protectionist groups of parliamentary devices, which in these sorts of instances in particular might allow them to extract concessions and favor local interests. McGinnis and Movsesian call this the domestic trade constitution, which has some special features with respect to the enactment of legislation in this area. And then the question is, does participation in the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade and the World Trade Organization have similar faction-controlling features? And in some respects, it does. The principle that underlies these international trade agreements is reciprocity. If you want us to lower your trade barriers for your goods, you have to lower your trade barriers for our goods. That gives domestic producer interests an incentive to keep our own tariffs low. So it helps to create a more, to strengthen the hand of those interests that favor lower trade barriers, and to this reciprocity regime helps to create a wider coalition on behalf of keeping our own trade barriers low enough so that we will be able to participate in this regime of reciprocity. The reciprocity regime strengthens the hand of diffuse general interests against special interests. And there are, you know, various examples of this working during the Reagan administration. Reagan is an example of a copyright protection for printers that came up, and Congress wanted to reenact this. And the fact that we were participating in international institutions gave the Reagan administration more leverage with respect to Congress in preventing the reenactment of this special interest protection for printers unions, because we would be retaliated against if we protected our own narrow interests in this way. And the World Trade Organization obviously has a wider tendency to help pursue these same sorts of general interests. There's been an astonishing reduction in tariff barriers since 1947, when the average tariff was 40% for various goods. Now it's down to 5%. The issue then becomes, and it's an interesting issue for democracy with respect to the World Trade Organization, what about laws that are enacted that seem to refer to health or safety regulations, but which might be covert protectionist enactments? So when the Europeans judge and say in their law that genetically modified food or hormone-treated beef might be dangerous for health, and they enact strictures to control the import of genetically modified agricultural products or hormone-treated beef, is that a legitimate domestic health regulation, safety regulation, or is it a covert protectionist legislation? The appellate bodies of the World Trade Organization are now deciding such issues that touch on domestic legislative matters, and they're handing down rulings through their appellate bodies, which are groups of experts, whether such judgments are backed by good science. And they've decided with respect to the European prohibition on genetically modified foods that it's not backed by good science. And of course, the American agriculture has engaged in genetically engineered food production much more aggressively than European agriculture has. So this, it has an impact on, a differential impact on American food and European food. So there are questions here about domestic democratic authority, our capacity to govern ourselves based on judgments about health and safety according to our own standards, no question about it. The question is, in a sense, can we understand the operation of the World Trade Organization as tending to do two things, tending to favor diffuse but general interests over special interests, and tending to operate in such a way that the scientific evidence that is being invoked in settling these questions it tends to be relatively sound. I think it makes sense to look at the quality of the decision making and the sort of interests that are being advantaged, and not simply to stop the analysis with noting that some decisions are being offloaded onto an institution that is not a purely domestic institution, that has this quality of being a multilateral and international institution. I think we have to look at the quality of the operation of such institutions and recognize that the question of whether it enhances or inhibits democracy is not a straightforward one. And indeed, I think I'm not a sufficient expert on this, but I think it's interesting to ask the question about the World Trade Organization, whether considering these complex standards for what constitutes democracy, and I don't see why we should accept anything other than complex standards for what constitutes democracy. If we think the United States is a democracy, constitutional democracy, yes, but again, I think constitutional democracy is the best way of understanding democracy in large modern states. And I think we have to ask the same complicated questions about the WTO, as we're asking about the Fed and judicial review and so on. Interestingly, when I gave this talk in Texas, a student in the audience used an example that also had a direct parallel with the Supreme Court in this regard. During the 2004 presidential election, I guess, Bush went to Pennsylvania and proposed tariff protections for steel to protect the Pennsylvania steel industry, perhaps knowing that would never get through, you know, that you'd never be able to get it through the WTO in Congress. But he was able to make what might be seen as a kind of specific appeal to the voters of Pennsylvania, knowing that in the end, this wasn't going to get through the procedures given the in place the W-2. Well, it's sort of like, you know, sort of, does this have an effect on democracy that James Bradley Thayer worried about with respect to the Supreme Court, that when the popular bodies can trust that at the end of the day the Supreme Court will strike down unconstitutional legislation, does this have the effect of meaning that congressional institutions will take constitutional principles less seriously? It's an interesting question. Is there a Thayer-esque danger embedded here? But it's the same sort of question that arises in these other contexts, and I think it has to be approached in the same way. The fact that there may be some qualification of sovereignty here, that we're offloading a certain decision to an international body, isn't enough to answer the question. I'm going to give another example of another international, it's much less well known, the Montreal Protocol on substances that deplete the ozone layer. Because this is an international body that the United States seems to have decided. The thing about the WTO is it doesn't have direct effect on U.S. law. What the WTO can do, the World Trade Organization, is allow countries to retaliate against other countries if a decision is seen to inhibit trade. So the United States was authorized to retaliate against the Europeans by raising our own trade barriers unless they remove this genetically modified prohibition from their law. The WTO doesn't sort of step into the national legislation and strike down genetic modification. Rather, it allows other countries to impose a cost, which will be in place unless the country itself modifies. But there's another thing. This Montreal Protocol seems to give an international body the right to make regulatory decisions with direct effect in U.S. law. So it's this is back in the 80s, sort of paralleling the discussion now about the greenhouse gases and so on. There was this big worry about the ozone layer being depleted, chlorofluorocarbons in air conditioners and so on. You read this, it kind of vaguely comes back to you that there was a big hole in the ozone layer and it was in the news and so on. Students won't remember this, but the rest of us might. And it was a big public outcry. It made it into the news in a way that greenhouse gas emissions have recently. And this is the waning years of the Reagan administration. And the idea was that countries would get together and form this international protocol that would regulate and eliminate ozone-depleting gases. And in 1987, there was a controversy within the Reagan administration whether to participate in this, and we decided to. George Shultz pushed for it over the objections of the EPA administrator of the time, who thought we should go it alone. So the parties to this agreement, the international parties to the agreement, now 190, maybe over 200 countries have signed up for this, agree in periodic meetings that certain chemicals will be identified, you know, based on science as ozone depleting, and they'll be put on a schedule of phase out. The mandate will be that by 2010, no country should no longer make use of whatever gas or chemical is deemed to deplete the ozone layer. Substitutions will be found. Subsequent part of this as well is that countries are unable to petition for critical use exemptions if there's some special need for this chemical and some sort of special process which warrants a special exemption. A chemical called methyl bromide was put on a schedule to elimination in 2003, I think it was. The United States petitioned for some special, I'm sorry, let me add one other thing. Congress amended the Clean Air Act such that the EPA is instructed to follow the decisions of the parties with respect to the elimination of these chemicals, this international body, and to set critical use exemptions no higher than is allowed by the parties. So Congress seems to have amended the Clean Air Act with the president's signature such that the regulatory decisions of the parties would have direct effect in U.S. law. We're a point of way that Congress could get out of by changing law, amending the Clean Air Act again, but we seem to have decided legislatively that this international body should set regulatory schedules for the elimination of certain chemicals based on environmental grounds. So it raises the question of whether Congress can delegate lawmaking power in this way. This methyl bromide chemical, we participated, we did the whole thing. The EPA hands down regulations, finally, at the end of the day, that exceed the limits set by the parties. And then the National Resources Defense Council sues the EPA for going above and beyond the schedule set by the parties to the protocol. And then the question becomes for federal courts, does this have the effect in U.S. law? Does this schedule of elimination and the exemption limits and so on, is this lawmaking as far as the U.S. is concerned, authorized by the Clean Air Act or not? And a federal court just decided in August, and apparently this is what they do with delegation issues, that it wasn't clear enough that Congress meant to delegate this this decision to the parties to the Montreal Protocol. It did say if the Congress did clearly delegate this power to the parties to the protocol, there could be a constitutional problem there with Congress delegating its lawmaking authority to someone else. But they didn't directly address that issue because they got around it by saying it wasn't clear enough. It looks like it's clear. So it does raise the question of how should we feel about democratic institutions offloading certain regulatory decisions of this sort and then getting, this is a qualification of sovereignty, but it might be good for democracy. The problem is that domestically, chemical companies and so on may have special power, may have special influence over regulatory decisions within an agency. You know, this whole thing about iron triangles and so on, how special interests can dominate administrative decisions. And the best way for us to participate in a national regime to pursue this public good of controlling gases that hurt the ozone layer, but also the best way of pursuing diffuse interests that and disempowering special interests may be by giving presumptive force in our own law to an international body, which allows us to cooperate with other countries and saying, let's all get rid of this stuff, we're all gonna do it together, we're all gonna agree to this rule, and we're not gonna send it back to the first stage of legislative process in our own countries in which special interests may be empowered and can derail the whole thing. So this looks, looks to me like a benign, apparently the way it works is science-driven. It does represent a qualification of U.S. sovereignty of a minor sort, but it looks like an international agreement that has a variety of good features to it. And as long as we know what we're doing, you know, as long as this was a conscious decision, as long as Congress hasn't delegated general, legislative powers to this body, as long as it's quite specific, then I think whatever worries we'd have about this are assuaged. Let me just talk about a couple of other examples. There would be negative examples. People going to walk out at 1 o'clock? There would be negative examples. We've got 5 minutes. Like the International Monetary Fund, and this is all based on pretty thin knowledge on my part, but so the International Monetary Fund may work in a way that empowers domestic factions internationally. I mean, if Joseph Stiglitz is right in his book, Globalization and Its Discontents, the IMF, with its governing board being composed of central bankers and Treasury Department officials, basically works globally to enhance the power of Western financial interests in a way that can be very bad for people in developing countries. Developing countries themselves don't sit at the table at the IMF, so their voices aren't heard. The World Bank operates somewhat differently. But this is another thing in my argument is that it's inevitable that international institutions cannot operate this way. It would depend on how they're constituted and what they're doing. But Stiglitz's book on globalization and discontents is very much about, if he's right, it's financial interests dominating decision-making within the IMF and in a way that a faction has advantaged itself through this international body. So there are lots of ways this might not work. Another one would be through the security law stuff. I mean, there's a committee of the Security Council now that lists groups or individuals that are charged with aiding terrorism, and there's a sanctions committee that operates in secret, designates individuals as aiders of terrorism, their assets can be frozen, and there's no individualized due process. So this is an instance where the United States has gotten the Security Council to, and countries have enacted this as part of their domestic law, that allows us to pursue our interest in national security, but in a way that downgrades our own constitutional commitments to individualized due process. So that's another negative example. A positive example, I'll just talk about on the side of criticism and sort of epistemic advantages would be, this is a bit anecdotal, but Colin Powell going to the United Nations before the Iraq War. Congress is controlled, this is a case where the separation of powers is broken down in some ways because the Republicans control all the two legislative branches as well as the executive branch. When everyone thought about the Gulf War at that time, and I had a hard time making my mind up about it. We know now that there wasn't sufficient critical examination of evidence relating to weapons of mass destruction, certainly. Colin Powell went to the CIA to gather evidence to make the case at the UN, which he hadn't looked into before. And his immediate reaction, to the draft speech that was prepared for him by the CIA to deliver at the UN was, what? In Karen DeYoung's book, Armitage's response was probably, apparently, this reads like a bad novel. We've got to do better than this. They spent the next couple of days. They didn't do what they might have done, which is to say, wait a minute here. Let's think about whether we really can make a credible case for weapons of mass destruction. They rather just did the best they could. But at least it was another opportunity in which when domestic voices are stilled, and we're not getting sufficient domestic criticism, an international body can be extremely helpful in bringing to bear critical voices that are missing domestically. Now, Radkin would say might say there's something wrong with that. If we have to go outside of the political community to get critical voices that we don't get domestically, there's something. It's at odds with the integrity of the democratic community. We shouldn't be needing foreigners in this context. We owe it to each other to justify things to one another. Let me just give you a quote respecting this, and I quote: "Inattention to the judgment of other nations is important to every government. In doubtful cases, particularly where the national councils may be warped by some strong passion or momentary interest, the presumed or known opinion of the impartial world may be the best guide that can be followed. What is not America lost by her want of character with foreign nations? And how many errors and follies would she not have avoided if the justice and propriety of her measures had, in every instance, been previously tried by the light in which they would probably appear to the unbiased part of mankind?" That's Madison Federalist Number 63, defending the Senate, defending precisely a body that would be remote from direct electoral connections, but would have a kind of independence from momentary whims and passions. Now, of course, the Senate is directly elected. The president is also less remote from elections as it was originally, because it was originally going to be chosen by the Electoral College. And this would be another, just a way in, anyway, this clearly the founders had none of this really quite radical suspicion of foreign opinion that is very strong in the Radkin book. It's really European opinion, but that's very strong indeed. So the question would be, again, as far as that goes, a la Anne-Marie Slaughter's work on non-governmental organizations and networks and so on, whether our involvement with international institutions has kind of provides with various epistemic resources, to put it pretentiously, but you're philosophers, so that enhance domestic contestation, reason giving, information, and so on and so forth. Alan Buchanan has written some very good things along these lines. So I won't say anything more. I'll probably conclude with that. I mean, there are reasons for concern about that. I mean, you look at Anne-Marie Slaughter's stuff, and there are some reasons for concern. Those who need to leave, I'll stop at this point, and I'll let people leave because it is 1 o'clock. And anyway, thank you very much.